Okay.
Okay.
Other things, just for public.
Icecast.
If that word means anything to you and you're a programmer and you know what that means, email Asia. If it doesn't, don't worry about it. Okay. Okay. We'll just tease it out there. Online meetings for the public. Remember, you can always still attend our board meetings, any of our committee meetings, any of those meetings that you could attend in station before are still being held online through Zoom. So check out kbu.fm and you can always get the link for any of those Zoom meetings. Uh-huh. And I actually kind of prefer it these days because it's a little more accessible. Well, actually, a lot more accessible. You can go attend our meetings from anywhere.
And don't have to pay for parking.
Yeah, don't even get me started around parking in downtown Portland-ish these days. Okay, in the last minute, Celeste, we're going to do one last little appeal to people because we have 1 minute.
Okay.
Why should people get to KBOO today for the spring fundraising appeal that ends in just a couple weeks?
To keep having fun, to keep hearing good news, to keep hearing the alternative options, not alternative facts. To be involved with your community and to have fun. Oh, did I say that? Oh, probably I didn't. Have fun.
Exactly. So have fun. Thank you so much to all who have supported us. And for those of you who are waiting to support, right now is the moment. Thank you. We love you. We miss all of you programmers. So, you know, but yeah, say hi to us in a Zoom meeting. How about that, everybody?
All right. We're going to call this Good News from the Boo.
Good news from the Boo. Have a good night, everyone. We'll talk to you next week.
Bye.
You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
From a quarantine studio brought to you by KPFK Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. In today's news headlines, several health experts testifying in front of the U.S. Senate on Tuesday warned lawmakers that it was far too soon to reopen businesses in the U.S., contradicting President Donald Trump's administration and several state governors. Dr. Anthony Fauci, in particular, stressed the importance of avoiding a second wave of infections until there is a vaccine, saying, quote, "It's a highly transmissible virus. It is likely there will be virus somewhere on this planet that will likely get back to us." Even the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention has warned against actions that could lead to a new spike in coronavirus infections. Associated Press has just obtained a 63-page CDC document, which is more detailed than an earlier one that was leaked last week, which was an organizational tool offering, quote, "a coordinated national response to give community leaders step-by-step instructions on how best to open businesses back up." The Trump administration has shelved this and other CDC documents. Meanwhile, Democratic lawmaker and Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer pushed the U.S. Senate to adopt a resolution calling for the release of the CDC's guidelines, but Republicans blocked the measure. Scientists outside the CDC also agree that reopening the nation too soon is a big mistake, as multiple models predicting the outcome of the pandemic say that there will likely be 110,000 U.S. deaths from the virus by June. Already, Americans are venturing outdoors as elected officials dither on stringent rules or begin to relax existing rules. A New York Times analysis of cell phone data found that 25 million more people ventured outside their homes on an average day last week than during the preceding 6 weeks. Additionally, in nearly every part of the country, the share of people staying home dropped, in some places by nearly 11 percentage points. In California, where Governor Gavin Newsom's early and strict guidelines had earned him praise, the rules are also set to be relaxed. Newsom this week announced that dine-in services can resume at restaurants in certain counties that meet guidelines. In those counties, shopping centers and other retail establishments will also be allowed to reopen. Seven counties have so far qualified, including Amador, Butte, El Dorado, Lassen, Nevada, Placer, and Shasta counties. Meanwhile, the California State University system said its campuses would remain closed through the fall semester. Jerome Powell, the chair of the Federal Reserve, gave a live digital address on Wednesday, warning that Congress and the White House need to approve more financial aid in order to revive the battered U.S. economy. Powell said, quote, additional fiscal support could be costly, but worth it if it helps avoid long-term economic damage and leaves us with a stronger recovery. On Tuesday, House Democrats revealed a massive $3 trillion aid bill called the HEROES Act, but progressive Democratic lawmakers slammed the bill as failing to adequately help the tens of millions of newly unemployed Americans or address their lost health care benefits. Congresswoman Pramila Jayapal tweeted that three things about the crisis need to be addressed, quote, getting people paychecks, ensuring access to health care, supporting businesses and their workers, and that the HEROES Act did none of them. Republicans instead appear to have chosen several weeks of inaction, or, as Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell called it, a wait-and-see approach. McConnell now wants any new bill to be, quote, narrowly targeted. His party says the Democrats' bill is, quote, dead on arrival. The Wall Street Journal on Wednesday reported that big corporations are receiving hundreds of billions of dollars in tax breaks they say are needed to tide over the economic crisis. According to the paper, quote, so far, more than 50 publicly traded companies have disclosed tax savings and deferrals totaling at least $2.8 billion, according to securities filings. Money is also going to private companies that don't report earnings. Additionally, new tax breaks expected to total about $650 billion are starting to flow. The tax breaks were part of an earlier congressional aid package that was passed into law. And the Washington Post reports that the Aspen Institute, an elite think tank that has a $115 million endowment and multiple billionaires on its board of trustees, received and accepted an $8 million small business loan through the Paycheck Protection Program. In other news, a federal judge has placed on hold the Justice Department's highly unorthodox decision to drop charges against Trump's former National Security Advisor, Michael Flynn. The judge says he expects several groups and individuals will challenge the DOJ's decision. The move comes as Acting Intelligence Director Richard Grenell was revealed to have handed over a list of Obama-era officials who first decided to investigate Flynn and his links to Russian operatives. Grenell turned over the list to Attorney General William Barr a day after Barr's decision to absolve Flynn. Meanwhile, Trump himself is the focus of several cases, including one before the Supreme Court, over his tax returns being made public. According to the Associated Press, quote, there was no apparent consensus about whether to ratify lower court rulings that the subpoenas to Trump's accountant and banks are valid and should be enforced. However, the court, quote, appeared likely to reject President Donald Trump's claim that he is immune from criminal investigation while in office. In another case involving allegations of sexual assault made against Trump by a woman named Summer Zervos, Trump's lawyers seemed to make exactly that case, that a sitting president, in their view, is immune from prosecution. That case is currently before the New York State Court of Appeals. Paul Manafort, Trump's disgraced former campaign manager, who had been serving a multi-year sentence over various charges of bank fraud as part of the special counsel's investigation, was just released from prison. Manafort was supposed to remain incarcerated until 2024, and yet he was granted early release to serve the rest of his term at home due to the dangers of the coronavirus. Mr. Barr had directed the Bureau of Prisons to release some prisoners who had only 18 or fewer months of their sentence left, or who had served more than half their sentence. Manafort did not qualify in either case. In an indication that wealthy, well-connected Americans receive preferential treatment in the criminal justice system, the Washington Post reported that many other federal prisoners who are vulnerable to infection remain incarcerated. Already there are reports of inmates dying from the coronavirus. California Representative Nanette Barragan toured Terminal Island Federal Prison in Southern California this week after a seventh inmate died of the COVID-19 virus. She told reporters, quote, I would hear the inmates screaming that were in isolation units saying, "Turn on the air, get us some air, help me, I need to make a call." And best-selling author Michelle Alexander, whose book The New Jim Crow shined a light on mass incarceration in the U.S., wrote an op-ed in the New York Times entitled "Let Our People Go." In it, Alexander said, "Our governments have been willing to shut down our entire economy, sparing only those sectors deemed essential. Shouldn't we also consider whether it is truly essential for millions of people to be caged?" And finally, Amy Stevens, the woman at the center of a landmark transgender rights case before the Supreme Court, died this week of kidney failure. She was 59. Stevens' civil rights case has sought workplace protections for transgender Americans over their gender identity. Donna Stevens, Amy's wife, released a statement saying she has given so many hope for the future of equality for LGBTQ people in our country, and she has rewritten history. The U.S. Supreme Court is expected to rule in the case in just days. And that does it for our news headlines today. We'll be back with the rest of the show after this break. KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. President Donald Trump has invoked the Defense Production Act on one industry, saying that it's essential that it remain open, and that is meatpacking or processing. There have been more than 4,000 COVID-19 infections among meatpacking workers, with at least 18 documented deaths. This has led to the employees of companies like Tyson, JBS, and Smithfield feeling reluctant about returning to work for fear of infection and death. But the industry is still failing to offer its workforce paid sick leave and is even blaming workers for the infections. Black and brown communities are disproportionately represented in the industry. 44% of meatpackers are Latino and 25% are Black. My guest is Tony Corbo, Senior Government Affairs Representative with Food and Water Watch and Food and Water Action. Welcome to the program, Tony.
Thank you for having me on.
So what is Trump's real justification? I mean, what is, I should say, the stated justification for invoking the Defense Production Act? This is a decades-old act that many lawmakers were hoping the president would invoke to do things like ensure healthcare workers have enough personal protective equipment. Instead, he has said that the meatpacking industry is deserving of this this act.
Well, what this administration has done is it's designated meatpacking and agriculture in general as an essential function that needs to continue to operate while the COVID-19 outbreak is occurring. So that means that these workers have to report to work. The USDA inspectors who are assigned to these plants also have to report to work. And what has been absolutely reprehensible about his action is the fact that he's ignoring that these workers are getting sick, some are dying, and it's because of the conditions within these meatpacking plants. It's not a surprise to me that they've turned into hot spots for this infection.
Business Insider reported that there were leaders in the industry that were blaming workers for the outbreak. Some certain communities where we've seen the meatpacking industry where there might be a factory and where workers are experiencing infections, that they're suggesting that workers are getting infected outside the workplace and bringing it into the workplace. This is a dangerous industry when it comes to a pandemic, right? Because in most situations, workers are shoulder to shoulder handling meat in a cold environment, which the virus likes, and having to shout to one another in order to be heard over the din of the equipment, right?
Absolutely. It's a dangerous industry regardless of whether there's a pandemic or not. The Occupational Safety and Health Administration has designated this industry as one of the most dangerous, apart from having a pandemic. And so for the industry leaders or even our government officials to blame the living conditions of these employees for bringing the virus to their work is absolutely wrong. As you properly stated, that these meatpacking plants, the environment that these workers are subjected to, are conducive to this virus spreading in their workplace.
Now, the meat industry, and it's controlled by giant agribusinesses, of course, such as the companies that I mentioned, they have suggested that there is an imminent meat shortage, which is why they lobbied the government for the Defense Production Act to be invoked. Your organization, Food and Water Watch, said that Smithfield's claim about food shortages during the coronavirus pandemic are essentially BS. Why? Can you explain?
Well, you know, first of all, there is still a lot of meat in cold storage, and that's because the fact that a lot of restaurants have been closed in a lot of communities due to the pandemic, and that meat is still in cold storage. And so there are millions of pounds of meat that is available if they just redirect the supply to consumers. The other thing that is just absolutely incredible to us is the fact that we're still exporting millions of pounds of meat around the world. Smithfield, in particular, is owned by the WH Group, which is based in China, and so that company, that Smithfield, was acquired by WH in 2013, and the stated purpose of the acquisition was to supply China with an ample supply of pork. The consumers and the Chinese consumers are big pork eaters, and so the fact that we're still exporting millions of pounds of meat abroad really undercuts the argument that there is a meat shortage. That supply can be directed to domestic consumption.
Right. Meat can be kept frozen. It is an industry where the product, you know, unlike, say, romaine lettuce, doesn't go bad if it's kept in cold storage. It can be kept, the inventory can remain for a very, very long time. So unlike the fresh produce, which there's many stories of that being destroyed because the industry is just unable to redirect it to where it's needed, the meat industry is not subject to that. So I understand that there's a backlog of animals, that of cattle and livestock, that they are eager to push through. And also, in general, if the government is insisting that this is an essential business, then the companies can force their workers to return to work and continue helping the company make profits. Is that the real goal?
Sure it is. I mean, this is an industry that has a history of not taking care of their workers. As you pointed out, a number of these companies do not offer paid sick leave. The employees are penalized for calling in sick. So a lot of these workers come to work sick to begin with. And you hear these horror stories of employees in these plants not being able to take rest breaks, so they're forced to wear adult diapers, depends.
Wow.
Where they're relieving themselves while they're working on the production line. So the bottom line is it's profits. It's not the worker safety that these companies are concerned with.
So workers in these meatpacking plants, if they feel symptoms, they don't get to take paid sick leave. If they basically stay at home because they're feeling symptoms, they lose pay and they could lose their jobs. I understand that the industry relies on short-term disability as a way to, which doesn't give you your full salary and is complicated to apply for. I imagine undocumented workers might not be eligible, but it's relying on this as a substitute for paid sick leave?
You're absolutely correct. And so, you know, so you're using for temporary disability. It takes time to apply. It takes time for the benefits to actually make it to the worker. And as you pointed out, some of these employees are undocumented immigrants, and they're not eligible to receive those benefits. And they're afraid to even apply for those benefits, even if they were eligible, because they could be exposed to deportation at that point.
I mentioned earlier that Black and brown communities are disproportionately represented among meatpacking workers. There are some unions that represent some of these workers. What rights do these workers have? Is it sort of patchy and sort of depending upon which company and you know which union represents what sort of workers?
Yeah, I mean, some of the plants are unionized. The Food and Commercial Workers Union, which is the biggest one that represents workers in meatpacking, they represent roughly 80% of the pork processors and beef processors in the country. But in the poultry plants, it's only 30% of the plants have been unionized, because a lot of the plants that do chicken slaughter and processing are located in the South, where there's a hostile anti-union environment. So in those plants that have been unionized, at least they have the workers have the benefit of the union going to bat for them. And we have seen in some of the instances where plants have been forced to shut down, that the union has intervened and insisted on certain protective equipment being made available to the workers before they reopened. But even in those situations, the unions have not been completely satisfied with all of the protective measures that needed to be taken before the plants were reopened. So there is a benefit to having union representation, where you have the union going to bat for the workers. But it's been very sketchy in terms of the success that the unions have been able to make in ensuring that all of the protective measures that should be made available to the workers are in fact followed.
Can unions and other advocacy organizations appeal to state authorities, to state governors, especially in states where businesses have not been deemed ready to be reopened? Or does the Defense Production Act allow them to be immune, these companies to be immune from state laws requiring continued lockdowns?
Well, it's been interesting to see that, you know, while the Defense Production Act has been invoked, there hasn't been a direct confrontation yet between local and state authorities and the federal government. If there's been disagreement, there's been some saber rattling by the Department of Agriculture Secretary Sonny Perdue, essentially really putting a little bit of pressure on the meat packers to reopen. But it remains to be seen if there's going to be a direct confrontation between state and local authorities and the federal government on reopening some of these plants that are not ready to be open at this point.
Now, the big companies that I mentioned, Smithfield and JBS, Tyson Foods, these are the ones that lobbied the Trump administration to have him invoke the Defense Production Act. They have also, I understand, successfully enabled a greater deregulation of their plants. I mean, these are, you know, big factories that are supposed to, in the interest of public health, be properly regulated, have inspectors, food USDA inspectors inspect them. Has have those inspections also been eroded?
Yes, I mean, in the poultry industry, for example, the big players, the Tysons of the world, JBS that owns Pilgrim's Pride, have been very successful in deregulating inspection in the plants. Traditionally, what's happened in slaughter in these facilities is that each USDA inspector was required to inspect 35 birds per minute in a chicken plant. And so the maximum line speed in those plants has been 140 birds per minute. So if that line is running at 140 birds per minute, you would have four USDA inspectors stationed on that line. What these companies were successful in doing, they were successful in doing it during the Obama administration. In 2014, USDA adopted what's called a new poultry inspection system, where the line speed could be increased up to 175 birds per minute, and only one USDA inspector is stationed at the end of the line. So from 35 birds per minute, now you have one inspector at the end of the line, essentially looking at three birds every second. So in the pork industry, Smithfield, JBS, and Tyson have been successful in getting the Trump administration to adopt what's called the new swine inspection system, where the number of USDA inspectors is reduced. The old standard was you would have seven inspectors on a line that could run at a maximum at 1,100 hogs per hour. And now what the new swine inspection system does is reduce the number of USDA inspectors to three, but there would be no cap on the line speed.
Wow.
So, and that just got implemented in December. And we've been trying to find out how many of these plants have requested conversion to this new system, how many have converted to the new system, and USDA now is refusing to disclose that information, claiming that it's confidential business information. So we're in the process of appealing that decision by USDA to in its refusal to disclose the information to us.
Seems as though this is precisely the moment when we need the kind of regulation that was put in place in the interest of public health and safety, right?
Absolutely. I mean, this instead of going forward, we're going backwards. We're going back to 1905. I mean, you had the 1906 Federal Meat Inspection Act that was adopted in order to end the company abuses and to improve food safety. And what we're doing is we're now reverting back to the way it was at the turn of the 20th century. And this is just absolutely incomprehensible as to why we're doing this to the workers working in these plants and to the consumers who are going to be placed at greater risk for food safety issues.
Now, the coronavirus, the novel coronavirus that has been named COVID-19, is thought to have originated at one of Wuhan, China's wet markets. But the meatpacking industry, which is dominated by factory farms that are poorly regulated, I imagine, are petri dishes for future viruses to develop like the one that we're plagued by now, right?
No, absolutely. I think you raise a very good point, is that, you know, the COVID-19 virus is a zoonotic disease that essentially got transmitted from an animal source to humans. And the way we're raising animals in this country, you know, at least the big meat packers are relying on these massive factory farms that are poorly regulated. The animals are essentially living in their own feces in most cases, and it's a breeding ground for new pathogens to develop. And the problem has always been that EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, has not exercised its authority to regulate these factory farms. And then USDA has not exercised its authority to really inspect what goes on those farms from a pathogen standpoint, in terms of the pathogen load that these animals are carrying as they're being taken to slaughter.
These are big companies. They are very profitable companies. They have they spend a lot of money lobbying government officials. We just heard this week that the governor of Nebraska, Pete Ricketts, has taken the extraordinary decision to not track COVID-19 cases at specific meat packing plants in his state, and you know, is using some bizarre justification of privacy, individual privacy, to defend his action. So they certainly share there's certainly an incentive to hide the infections that are breaking out at these meatpacking plants, because these are massive companies that want to protect their profits. So on that note, and I know that Food and Water Watch just released a new report mapping factory farms all over the U.S. Shouldn't this story, this particular chapter of the pandemic and how it's impacting meatpacking plants, really be an opportunity to address the terrible toll that factory farms take on people, on the environment, on health? Factory farms are really quite disgusting industries. I mean, it seems as though the jungle is alive and well, to invoke Upton Sinclair's classic novel.
No, I think you're absolutely correct. I think, if nothing else, the COVID-19 outbreak has really put a light on how broken our food system is in this country. That there's massive concentration. The way we're raising the animals, the meat animals, the fact that there's little or no regulation from farm all the way to the slaughterhouse. There really needs to be a focus and action taken by the government to address the systemic issues that this outbreak has caused.
I understand that there is a bill in Congress called the Farm System Reform Act that both in House and Senate that would actually be that kind of necessary government action to transition factory farms away from the way in which they currently operate, that I imagine would address the COVID-19 infections, but in general, the health and safety of workers and the products.
Yeah, Senator Cory Booker introduced the Farm System Reform Act in late 2019. And then a companion bill was just introduced by Representative Ro Khanna in the House that would essentially place a moratorium on any new factory farms being developed, and also focusing in on the concentration that's going on in the meat industry, and to give power to an agency within USDA, the Grain Inspection Packers and Stockyards Administration, the power to regulate concentration, and to also call on the Department of Justice to use its antitrust authorities to break up these monopolies that have essentially been created in the food industry. So this pandemic, as I said, has really focused on the shortcomings of our food system, and these two bills would go a long way to remedying what is going on right now.
And so that's certainly something that people who are worried about the state of our food industry, in particular factory farms and the meatpacking industry, can ask their representatives to support. Give out a website, Tony, for your organization, Food and Water Watch.
Yes, it's www.foodandwaterwatch.org.
We'll post a link to that from our website. Tony, thanks so much for joining us.
Well, thank you very much for having this on, and hope if any of your viewers have any additional questions, please contact us.
Again, that's foodandwaterwatch.org. My guest has been Tony Corbo, Senior Government Affairs Representative with Food and Water Watch and Food and Water Action. We've been discussing the state of the meatpacking industry during the pandemic. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify. From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. For years, the term deep state was the purview of fringe activists on the right and the left, used to refer to the invisible aspects of governance and policy controlled by America's vast and powerful intelligence agencies. Since Donald Trump's presidency, that phrase has entered the mainstream lexicon, primarily because Trump himself uses it to promote the idea that intelligence officials are secretly working behind the scenes to undermine him. It doesn't help that agencies like the FBI and CIA have a sordid and well-documented history of violating rights and pushing the envelope of legality. My guest today is David Rode, two-time recipient of the Pulitzer Prize, executive editor of the New Yorker website, and a former Reuters, New York Times, and Christian Science Monitor reporter. He was captured by the Afghan Taliban more than 10 years ago and held for many months before escaping and reporting on the Afghan war. His new book is called In Deep, The FBI, the CIA, and the Truth About America's Deep State. Welcome to the program, David.
Thank you, Sonali.
So what does Trump mean specifically when he uses the term deep state? He tweets it all the time. Does he specify what this term means to him?
It's changed over time. Initially, he used the deep state when he was sort of referring to the FBI investigation of his campaign's ties with Russia. He also applied it to CIA officials. It's grown, though. He at one point, he was pushing for an American Special Forces soldier to not be tried by the U.S. military for war crimes. And then he sort of declared the Pentagon at that time part of the deep state. And more recently, Trump himself has not used the term, but many of his supporters have accused Dr. Tony Fauci, one of the country's leading infectious disease experts, of being a member of the deep state as well. And they accuse him of exaggerating the threat of coronavirus as a way to undermine the economy and the president's re-election chances. So part of the reason I wrote the book is because there's no one's clear sort of what exactly the term means, and many people, including the president, use it in different ways.
Where did the term originate? Obviously, Trump didn't come up with it. I mentioned that it's been a favorite of, you know, conspiracy theorists on the right and on the left. But is it a uniquely American term?
No, it was actually first used to describe the military in Turkey. And political scientists use it to talk about the tendency of the military there to try to block the development a democracy in the country. Some people applied it to the military in Egypt as well. And the first, you know, example I could find of it being used in the United States was actually by an academic in California, Peter Dale Scott. He's a retired professor from the University of UC Berkeley. And in a 2007 book, Scott applied the term deep state for the first time, as far as I could tell, to the American government. And he came from more of a critique from the left. Scott argued that the American deep state, and he defined it as sort of military contractors, generals. He also talked about it as financial interests on Wall Street, had pushed the U.S. into endless wars and before and after 9/11. So he used it in his book, but again, he was coming more from the left perspective of the military-industrial complex.
So if we focus on the definition, at least Trump's definition of the deep state, including or encompassing today's intelligence agencies, I want to ask you to lay out for those who, you know, aren't scholars of the American government system, what the relationship is supposed to be between agencies like the FBI, the CIA, which of course under the FBI being under the purview of the Justice Department, and the White House, the executive branch. The president is supposed to appoint heads of these agencies, but there's supposed to be a firewall between them, right? They're supposed to be independent.
They're supposed to be independent, and we can talk about this more, but there was a series of investigations in the 70s by Congress, and there was a decision that it was very important that the FBI and the CIA, given their power, not be used for political purposes by presidents. And it was also deemed that FBI officials and CIA operatives, would not be distorting the information that they were providing to the president. And the reason for this is that many of our sort of biggest intelligence debacles, anywhere from the Bay of Pigs to the Iraq invasion in 2003, came about when, intelligence analysts were sort of telling presidents what they wanted to hear. Part of those reforms also was that there would be oversight of these agencies by Congress as well. In the late 70s, after these abuses were found, intelligence committees were created in Congress, in the House, and the Senate. A new system was created where the president, instead of, the president would have sort of a verbal communication with the CIA director about, covert action programs the U.S. was carrying out. After these reforms, the president had to sign a written covert action finding. That document was then given to the heads of both parties in Congress. And there was also a ban on the U.S. carrying out assassinations, the CIA carrying out assassinations abroad, or CIA agents posing as journalists. And lastly, the judicial branch was involved as well. A special court was created, the FISA court, to monitor efforts by the FBI to surveil Americans as part of counterterrorism or counterintelligence investigations. And so the goal was to have overlapping oversight. You'd have a president overlooking the agencies, and you'd also have Congress and the courts as well.
So we are in a place now where President Trump has, conveniently used this idea that these intelligence agencies are working against him to undermine legitimate investigations of how his campaign conducted itself, of how he and his colleagues have conducted themselves during his presidency. It's a very convenient ruse, and his base seems to buy it. It's also one that's promoted by Fox News, right?
It is, and I'm going to try to be if it still exists these days, the sort of more non-partisan journalist. Look, there is no question, as you said at the very beginning of the interview, there's a long history of CIA and FBI abuses. What did change with these reforms in the 70s is the misconduct that's happened since then. It's usually been at the direction of presidents. George W. Bush, told the CIA to carry out rendition and torture. George W. Bush, told them to carry out warrantless mass surveillance. President Obama, carried out a record number of drone strikes around the world to counter terrorism. So the idea of these rogue agencies, that really hasn't happened in the last 40 years. And I essentially came to the conclusion that the term deep state is political rhetoric. I don't like it. I think it's, it's inaccurate. It sounds like a conspiracy. If you really like government, a term you could use that I think is also political rhetoric would be like good government. I think there's a permanent government, I use the term institutional government. We have these institutions that continue to function no matter who's president. But what's different is, you know, every president has come to Washington and complained about these institutions, these bureaucrats. They'd say, you know, they leak stories, you know. But what I found is that the loyalty of most career civil servants is to their institution. They will leak stories to influence policy. They'll fight for turf or bigger budget. You know, Ronald Reagan came to Washington and complained the State Department was, you know, not implementing his tough on communism policy. Barack Obama came to Washington. He was suspicious of the Pentagon. He thought Pentagon generals were leaking large proposed troop increases in Afghanistan to force Obama to send a large number of troops. But, you know, I found no evidence of a deep state, of a coup, you know, a plot against President Trump. I think he's, you know, he's exaggerating what's happening, and he's using he uses the term very effectively to discredit enemies. Any sort of officials who question him or question or contradict his political messages, you know, are declared members of the deep state.
And on the contrary, now his Justice Department, and I say his because Attorney General William Barr has acted more often like the president's personal attorney than the chief, you know, than the nation's attorney general. Trump's Justice Department seems to be engaged in a very overt conspiracy to punish anybody who has tried to investigate Trump, anybody who was involved in not just the special counsel's investigation, but also the impeachment proceedings, the initial whistleblower complaint that led to the impeachment articles around the involvement with the Ukraine government. That's all out in the open, right? Let's talk about William Barr and the role that he has played.
So Barr is a central character in the book. And long before, you know, Donald Trump was running for president, Barr felt that these reforms that were enacted in the 70s were excessive, he felt, that they gave Congress and the courts too much power. Barr was one of a number of conservatives who felt that the presidency was weakened too much in the wake of Watergate. Other people who agree with him were two aides to President Ford. They were very young at the time, but that was Dick Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld. And Antonin Scalia, who was a conservative legal scholar at the time but went on to become a Supreme Court justice, felt the same way. So Barr's worked for years. He worked in the Reagan White House. Ed Meese, Reagan's attorney general, also was focused on trying to restore the power of the presidency. And this moment under President Trump, you know, Barr has completely embraced this. He argued in a speech last fall to the Federalist Society that we need a stronger executive branch, that when you look historically at which branch of the government has saved the country when it faces natural disaster or war, you know, or economic crises, it's been the executive branch. And so he was, you know, Barr complained about, you know, a federal judge in, I think in California on the West Coast stopping President Trump's travel ban, that was an infringement on a president's power as Barr reads the Constitution. He's criticized these investigations by Congress as overkill, and he believes special counsel should not be appointed, that again is an infringement of the power of the president to run the executive branch as he sees fit. So he's very dismissive of the Mueller investigation, and you're right, he's launched an investigation of the investigators. He's accused them of wrongdoing. He dropped the charges against Flynn. And now, you know, other legal scholars say this is, you know, a disaster. It's rebalancing the sort of basic division of powers that's a core of our democracy, where you have three co-equal branches of government that compete with each other and act as checks on each other. So I came to the conclusion in the book that sort of under the guise of stopping a coup that doesn't really exist, Trump, you know, with the help of Bill Barr, is sort of rebalancing the division of powers in American democracy. And it's a very stark and I think dangerous trend that's happening.
Yes, it's quite shocking. We also, there was just, as an aside, a recent interview where William Barr, when asked about his decision to drop charges against a former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn, when he was asked how history would view his actions. He started his answer saying history is written by the winners. Let's focus also on the George W. Bush administration. Your book is about the FBI, about the CIA, and about Trump's claims of a deep state. The CIA, especially during the Bush administration, this is the second Bush administration, became an especially notorious agency, particularly around the war on terrorism. Why is this a critical part of the story?
Because the story is really the effort to control the FBI and CIA, and it starts with these reforms again in the late 70s, and Bush flouts them. He essentially says, I, as president, you know, can carry out a mass surveillance program, and I don't need to go to this FISA court, the federal court that was created to stop abuses. And there was, you know, very famous legal memos written by John Yoo, who was in the Justice Department at that time, authorizing the use of torture and renditions and other methods to combat terrorism. Many Americans, you know, did support those methods. There was a huge upturn in support for a powerful presidency and for the FBI and the CIA after 9/11. But I think many people were troubled by, you know, the methods that were used. Bush, once the New York Times reported the existence of the mass surveillance, it was very unpopular, and Bush ended up going to the court and getting permission. So the idea of checks and balances of, you know, controlling a president and controlling how the CIA and FBI are used is popular in among Americans. But, you know, the president Trump has been very effective at saying, no, you know, there is the problem are these unelected officials. You know, I'm the elected president and they're, you know, trying to overthrow me. Again, I even had members of Trump's own administration agree that was an exaggeration. Again, Trump officials, I talked to Obama administration officials, Bush administration officials, Clinton administration officials, lots of frustration with the machinations of bureaucrats in Washington. But even Trump's own aides said no evidence of a coup.
How do you, as a journalist, assess the FBI's role and in intelligence community's role in trying to unearth what the Trump campaign and eventually the Trump presidency was engaged in? It was under Obama that the investigations into what Michael Flynn's, you know, what Michael Flynn did or did not do started, his connections, his contact with Russian operatives. Do you assess whether the investigation was fairly started?
I do. I partly based on there was a review by the Inspector General of the Justice Department, Horowitz, that found they were properly launched. And I interviewed James Baker. He was the general counsel of the FBI. And involved in the launch of the investigations. I didn't speak to former Director Comey. And, you know, Baker stands by the launch of the investigations, and that actually occurred in July of 2016. You know, the DNC emails had been stolen and by Russia, it was believed. President Trump had publicly asked Russia at that point to find Hillary Clinton's emails. And there was this report of a Trump campaign operative, George Papadopoulos, saying that Russia had dirt on Hillary Clinton and wanted to share it, and they launched the investigation. At that point, they didn't have the dossier by Christopher Steele, much of which has proven to be false, was not instrumental to the launch of the investigation. And then as a reporter, I spent the summer of 2016 trying to confirm that the FBI was investigating Trump's campaign. You know, and the FBI refused to confirm that they were. They didn't confirm it with any journalists that summer. Again, if there was an FBI plot to derail the Trump campaign, the easiest way to do that would have been to leak the fact that they were investigating Trump. They never did that. In fact, James Comey reopened the Hillary Clinton email investigation days before the election, which hurt her. And just one other anecdote, I went to James Clapper for an interview. I was doing a story about the CIA. And I asked him about reports in the Steele dossier of, you know, that Russia had compromising videotapes of Donald Trump. This was about 6 months before the 2016 election. And I asked Brennan if he could confirm that there were such tapes. And Brennan, you know, declined to comment. He said, I'm not confirming this thing you've heard about tapes. I'm not denying this thing you've heard about tapes. I don't want to go anywhere near this. And Brennan actually urged me. He said, you're going to hear a lot of crazy things about, you know, Donald Trump over the last few weeks of the campaign and crazy things about Hillary Clinton. You know, he urged me to be more conservative than ever in terms of what I reported before the election. So no, you know, I'm not saying we should trust the CIA or the FBI.
Right.
We should have very aggressive oversight by the press, by the courts, by Congress. But this talk of a plot, you know, isn't true. There was a problem that was found by the Inspector General, Carter Page. He was a former Trump campaign advisor. He was surveilled. There was a warrant obtained by the federal court. But it shouldn't have gone on for as long as it went on. The last two applications were approved, and it was egregious. There was a case where an FBI lawyer changed an email. Carter Page he was under suspicion because he was meeting with Russian government officials. The email explained that Carter Page was talking to the CIA after these meetings with Russian government officials, and the email was changed to say that Page was not cooperating with the CIA when he actually was. That's egregious. You know, that should be investigated. But again, you know, so the first two applications for the several months for surveilling Page were proper, according to the Inspector General's report. The last 2 months weren't. But again, that is completely different from claiming that the FBI was secretly wiretapping Trump Tower, or again, talking about a coup.
There have been a number of low-level and even upper-level staffers that have either been fired or resigned from these various intelligence agencies under the Trump administration. I understand morale is quite low within these agencies. You know, there are people who have signed up publicly onto letters demanding that William Barr be held accountable for his very political and politicized decisions. What do you think the future of the intelligence community is with the Trump presidency and even past the Trump presidency? Has Trump sort of left an indelible mark on the intelligence agencies?
So I found that the FBI and CIA, the personnel, were sort of just as divided as the rest of the country.
Hmm.
There's a, you know, group that, you know, supports President Trump and a group that doesn't like him at all. What worried me most was that there was a great sense of alienation among folks that I talked to. They felt that the political class was sort of using the FBI and the CIA to score points increasingly when there's information that they find or a criminal case that they bring that helps, you know, either side's political narrative. It's hyped by that side. When there's, you know, information that doesn't match either side's political narrative, it's sort of downplayed or doesn't get much interest. And so there's a sense of apathy. One of the characters in the book went to there was a congressional hearing where John Stewart testified about first responders, you know, who were getting cancer from going to the Pentagon and the World Trade Center, not getting enough support for Congress. And I asked this person, he was an FBI agent who was retiring, you know, he was just sort of, you know, very frustrated with the political class, a pox on all their houses, again, not being Republican or Democratic. And I said, well, would you ever, you know, you're retiring, would you ever run for office? And the FBI, former FBI agent said, no, you know, I want to do something that has meaning. And that's a bad, bad sign for our democracy when there's that much alienation going on. And, you know, I wrote this book to examine one conspiracy theory and found that it wasn't true. And I just worry that we're trapped in this cycle of division and distrust and conspiracy theory that's leading us to be unable to agree on basic facts, even coronavirus and how to respond to it.
Right. The Trump administration has clashed with its own intelligence leaders around the origin of the COVID-19 virus because the intelligence community does not adopt his conspiracy theory about it being created in a lab in Wuhan, China. Well, David, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. Good luck with the book, and thanks for spending this time with us.
Thank you, Sonali. Thank you so much.
My guest has been David Rode. He's a two-time recipient of the Pulitzer Prize, executive editor of the New Yorker website, former Reuters, New York Times, and Christian Science Monitor reporter. And we've been discussing his new book, In Deep, The FBI, the CIA, and the Truth About America's Deep State. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also, follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RUWithSonali.
Rising Up with Sonali is hosted, written, and executive produced by Sonali Kohatkar. Anna Buss is the producer, technical director, and web and social media supervisor. Our theme music is by Grammy Award-winning band, Gets Up. Like us on facebook.com/RU with Sonali. That's the letters RU with Sonali. And follow us on twitter.com/RU with Sonali. Our website is risingupwithsonali.com, where you can find all our programs archived and where you can get direct access to all our video and audio files.
Portland.
Somebody help me, set me free. I can't take this new-